Welcome back. How was lunch? Pretty good? Yeah? Okay. Not rave reviews, but no complaints? All right. We're going to move now into, we've talked about the web, we've talked about some of the core framework pieces. We're going to talk about Windows Workflow Foundation 4, that's part of .NET Framework 4. See if I can catch up here. So we're going to take a look at the runtime and how we execute workflows. We're going to look at the model for declaring or building our workflows. We're going to talk about the data flow, which is completely different from the previous version. And then we'll look at basics of how you host and run these things, the different options you have. And then finally, we'll look at the customizations or the extensibility and how you can write custom activities or components for your workflows. So before we get started, how many people have been working with workflow in .NET 3 or 3.5? Okay, surprising number of people. How many of you like it? Not quite as many. Hopefully, what you'll see with workflow 4 is, will make you happy. So it's kind of an interesting thing with Microsoft and other companies and their version numbers. Right? It's workflow version 4 because it's in .NET 4. But it's actually the third release of Workflow. So it's Workflow in 3.0 and some minor updates in 3.5. But Workflow also was kind of born out of or came from a lot of the work that happened in the BizTalk space. So it's probably like version 7. So it's Workflow 4. It's essentially the second major release of the Workflow framework. And it's part of the .NET framework, so it'll ship right out of the box. And they've started over. Right, they took Workflow from .NET 3 and 3.5, and they said, look, the concept is solid. People really like the ability to declare these programs, to be able to go out and compose these units of work together, these activities. Right, we're really onto something. They like the framework, but there's some designer issues, right, in terms of the complexity and the scalability of things in the designer. There's some performance questions that people have. It's always the case when you go and you talk to you talk to a group like this, or you ever present and you talk about, hey, we've got this great framework, and if you go do this, all right, then you can do this, and you can call this from your .NET code, and somebody will always say, hey, does it perform as fast as C# or VB? Right. Well, it's a framework. You get a runtime. Is .NET quite as fast as raw C++? Probably not, but I'd rather write .NET. Right, it's fast enough, and in some cases it works out pretty well. Right, we talk about Windows Communication Foundation later. People will say, "Hey, is if I do Windows Communication, is that as fast as doing raw sockets?" Well, no, right, because I have a framework on top of that that's going to do some things. It's pretty good. In a lot of cases, you get pretty close. There's a lot of benefits I'm getting from using that framework. Right? With Workflow 4, you get pretty darn close to .NET framework component speed because of the way they've re-architected and redesigned it. And the idea is that they want to provide a framework that you can use in any style of application. Right. So for those of you who are not familiar with it, let me just set out and kind of say at a high level, right, Windows Workflow is a framework. Right. It is a runtime. It is a set of tools to define your workflows. And the framework that you build on, it is not a server product. Right? You don't go drop it in and have this enterprise-scale workflow solution with all sorts of task management and integration with Active Directory and those sorts of things. It is a framework. It is a flexible framework that's intended to be used from any .NET application. Right? You can call workflows from your web application. You can call it from your rich client applications. A lot of the components of Workflow fit into that client profile I mentioned this morning. So we've got the .NET Framework 4 client profile. You can write workflows that will run on the client workstation because those components will be part of that client profile. Not only can you build logic that you can execute just synchronously, if you will, just to call a workflow and run it in a page, but you can build long-running processes where you have the notion of doing some work and then maybe waiting for some user input and resuming that work and picking up where you left off. So you can use the workflow framework to define that overall process and define the points where you're going to wait for that input and receive that data. You can also use it to write services, web services. So rather than going in and writing a bunch of C-sharp code to implement your operations or your methods, as you would with WCF or the ASMX web services, you write a workflow that declares the overall process and allows you to send and receive messages to web services. So that's just kind of a quick pass for those of you who aren't as familiar with it. If you're not, don't worry, because they've changed enough that it'd probably be easier for me to do a talk on what's old in WF4 and talk about the things that stayed the same. So in workflow, the core atom that we work with is the activity. Right? An activity is what you're primarily going to work with, and an activity is made up of some data in the form of arguments, generally, and execution. Right? Much like a control in one of your presentation frameworks, I've got some class, this activity, I configure it or I provide it inputs, and then I execute it and it does something. Unlike user interface components that when they do something, they usually render, the activities can do anything that you want. Right? They can go out and call your APIs. They can go out and interact with services, databases, whatever it is you want them to do. A workflow is nothing more than an activity. Right? It just happens to be the activity that's at the top of your hierarchy. So as we talk about building a workflow, what we're really doing is just building a tree of activities. Now, the easiest way I've found to think of this is when you build a program in code, think about a basic console application, where do you start? What's the program statement that starts in your console application? Your main. What's special about main? Nothing really. Right? It's just a convention that, hey, we have this thing called main. That's where we know, that's where .NET knows to start that application. When we have a workflow, that root level activity is our workflow, and that just happens to be where we start processing. And just like main is a program statement in code, we have other program statements like if else, we have write line, we've got objects like the mail client that we can send mail. Well, in workflow, we have activities to do that. Each activity is a program statement. It might be an activity that's going to go out and send a mail, right, or go out and do some action, or it might be an activity that is going to control the flow of execution, like an if else or a while. So in .NET 4, right, we have these activities, but we also have the data. So if you think about business logic or a process that you're going to define in an application, you're going to have the program statements, you're going to have the things to do, but you're also going to have to operate on some data. And the nice thing is that in this move from workflow 3 to 4, what they've done is they've taken the data and moved it into a model that's actually very familiar for .NET developers. We have arguments, which would do exactly what you'd guess they'd do. They allow you to pass data into or out of some activity, right? Just like you have arguments to functions. We've got variables. Guess what? They're for storing data. Just like variables within a method or variables within a class. And they have a scope. Right? Just like if you had to define a variable within a method, that's where it's accessible from within that method. And finally, we have expressions. And this is a kind of a powerful feature of workflow 4 where we get to do our data manipulation. Right? Now, an expression generally performs some sort of operation and returns a result. Usually what you'll use an expression for is to set some argument. So if I'm going to go out and I have an activity, I'm going to configure it, rather than just being able to put static values on there, I can put this rich expression, which is essentially code, right, and I can gather information from variables, call out to .NET classes, can do any number of things in order to return the result that I'm expecting. So we have activities like a sequence. That sequence provides a scope for me, much like a method would provide a scope or a class. I can define variables at that scope, and I can access them throughout that entire scope of execution, so for the duration of that particular sequence. Now, for those of you that are familiar with workflow in 3 and 3.5, this is very different. In the previous versions, when you had data, it was available for the lifetime of the workflow. Right? Even if you only used it in the first step and never again, and even if your workflow lasted for 5 days or 5 months, that data was kept around and stored. Right? So now we get data scoping, which means I have more control over it, but it also means if I want to save out state, I've got a lot less to manage, I've got a lot less to deal with in terms of the active data in my process. Another new thing that they've added is that they have a flow chart. So in workflow 3, we had sequence and state machine as the two kind of out-of-the-box templates that you could choose. You could say, I want to build a new workflow. Here are the choices I'm going to get in Visual Studio for that, the main, right? That top-level activity was sequence or state machine. They did a little flip-flop here. You still have sequence. State machine has gone away, and now you have flowchart. And the idea here is that you need a little more flexibility in the control flow. Right? You need to be able to make some decisions, be able to loop back and repeat certain steps of your workflow based on the current situation. And this model, you know, if you take a look at it, really probably more closely matches what people think about, business analysts and developers, as they map out a process. Right. It's more of a flow chart kind of model that you see people using, whether they use Visio to draw some sort of an activity flow diagram, or they're using UML, or they're just scratching it out on a napkin. Right. This more closely matches with how people think about the flow of an application. All right. So let's go in and just give you a sense of the model here. I'm going to do a new project. And if I go under workflow, there's a couple of different things that I can choose here in terms of projects. I have a workflow console app. That's for demos. And it's also, you know, gives you a nice driver if you want to go out and create this thing. Right? So I can go create a console application, and I can get out some input, and I can show it to you. One of the nice things about Workflow 4 is that it actually works very well with unit testing frameworks as well. So do we have fans of unit testing and test-first design? Excellent. That's the most hands I've seen raised yet to a question. So the activities, right, are something that you can execute. You can go out and execute those, get back results, do your assertions, and it's much easier to set that up and run it. There's not a lot of overhead to doing that. We also have the service application. I'm actually going to talk about that in the WCF talk because it's more geared towards services. We have an activity library, which is I'm going to create a DLL, and in that I'm going to store activities, and those may be just small units of work, like that send mail, or it might be an entire process that I would consider a workflow. And we've also got the ability to do custom designers. All right, just to get started, I'm going to go ahead and do the demo model. Because I want to write some things out so you can see some outputs and see how the inputs and outputs work. We can do a unit test as well if we have time. But so what I get is my design surface. You'll notice it's completely empty, which means that from the start I have no notion of what the control flow is. I essentially have no main here. And what I'm doing with my workflow is I'm going to model out declaratively my program logic. I'm going to put program statements in here. So if we look at the toolbox, you can see that I've got my set of activities over here. So I have one section that's my control flow. We'll see if I can do this without crashing. So over the break, I got some good feedback. People politely said, they were actually much more polite than this. They said, hey, you should pay attention and you should actually apply those hot fixes that Scott Guthrie and everybody's always talking about for your IntelliSense, because that's why your Visual Studio is crashing. And my response was, yes, I should, but it's never crashed before. And then somebody else pointed out that it's because I was using a screen magnifier, which acts like a reading device, and that's one of the core use cases where this stuff breaks. So I'm no longer using the screen magnifier. So hopefully I will stop killing Visual Studio. So these should look familiar. Right? If you're used to doing .NET code, the concepts here of for each, do while, right, switch, these aren't new concepts. And the applications you write with workflow aren't new kinds of applications. A lot of people get hung up and say, well, I don't really write workflow applications. You probably write applications that could use workflow. Right? If you write applications where users provide input, and then you wait, and then they provide more input, web applications, right, WPF applications, then you might be able to use workflow. Right? But there's also some things here that you probably won't see that often in code, things like parallel and parallel for each, right? Where I want to be able to go in and say, hey, look, I'm going to run some set of code, and I want to do it in parallel. And I don't want to have to spin up threads and things like that. Right? Again, we talked about the task library earlier this morning. That's kind of a low level, taking advantage of CPUs and things. This is more a declarative model where I say, look, I just want to say these are the different things I want to do and have them run in parallel. And we've got other activities over here for the flowchart, which I'll talk about. We've got activities for error handling and dealing with collections and transactions. We've got some things like an assign and invoke method. And so if I want to come in and create a process, I need to identify what that root control flow is going to look like. I'm going to go ahead and throw a sequence in here, which basically is what we would get with .NET code. It's going to execute every program state beneath it in order. Now, if I'm going to do something in this workflow, I probably need some data. I'm going to want to operate on something. So let me go add a reference out to my project here. I've just got some .NET types out here, very simple, just an expense report. All right, got amounts and who the employee is and what the report is for, just something to work with. And so in the workflow, what I want to be able to do is I want to process a collection of these expense reports. You submit a bunch to me, and I want to go through them and do something. Well, I need a way to pass that in, and so I'm going to use the arguments window down here. I can create an argument, and I'll call this reports. I better build, otherwise I won't get the type information. So I have the reports. The direction is in. And for the argument type, I'm going to go out and browse. I'll say I want a list of T. It's going to ask me what T is. So I get into a little recursion here where I have another one. I go to my expense, my contracts and expense report. So I'm basically telling it, hey, I want an argument. It's going to be of type list of expense report. There it is, and it's got a name of reports. Now, let me go out here. I'm going to create a couple other collections, one for reports that that we've accepted, and one, and one for reports that we've rejected. Now, I'm going to make these out arguments. So I've got a workflow or an activity. It's got input arguments. It's got output arguments. What does that sound like to you as a .NET developer? What do you work with in code that takes input arguments and gives you output arguments? Just a function. Okay. And we'll see when I get done, I'll be able to call this workflow very much like a function, where I'll be able to pass it the arguments, have the whole thing execute, and get some results back. The benefit is that I have this model now where I can come in and declare this. I have an easier model to come in and change things, fix things up, provides me some benefits beyond just a method call. All right. So I've got these reports coming in. For these reports going out, I also need to initialize them. Since that's an out, so what I'm going to do is use this assign right at the beginning, and I'm going to say, well, accepted reports. You can see I get IntelliSense up here, and I'm going to say it's a new list of T, and that's list of expense report. Oh, thank you. I love audience IntelliSense. There we go. Now I just need to build to get rid of all the real IntelliSense that doesn't like it. Accepted reports, collection, generic list of expense report. Oh, yeah. There we go. Just needed to fix it up. It was still thinking it was a string. So what this assign activity does is it just says, hey, look, I want to take some value or some expression, and I want to assign it into some other value. It's just doing it's just setting that thing, right? And the reason I have that is, as we'll talk about, I don't have a code behind. Right. So this is the way that I write code. I use the expressions, I use activities to declare all the program logic and the program statements within my workflow. So I've initialized those things. Now I can start using some of my control flow. And I'll use this for each of t. And what this allows me to do is set the type of the items. So I'm going to go browse and get my expense report again. I'm going to say, well, I want to iterate over a collection of expense reports. So for each item in reports. Right. And now I have this body in here where I can identify what I want to do with each of those particular items. Yeah, we'll just throw an if activity in there. And so you can see now the highlighted in yellow is my if activity, which just like code would say, all right, I want to go out and look at that item and check some condition. So it's expecting an expression in here that would return true or false. I could type in a literal, right, true or false. I can type in item amount less than 100. I can use code in here. And so I might say item amount less than 100 and item dot equals mat. Now, one thing you might notice, if you were here this morning, you'll notice I'm having trouble typing it. Same reason I had trouble this morning, it's VB. All right. It's a C-sharp project. The expression language is Visual Basic. So that's why you'll notice I've got things in here like and instead of the double ampersand, and I have a single equal sign instead of double equal sign for equality. So it may catch you up if you're a C-sharp developer. Oh, because employee is not a string. Right. So it may throw you off a little bit, but that there's not a lot of things that you really have to keep track of. You know, you're not dealing mostly with curly braces and things. So I've got item amount, and then I'm just going to go down here and use some of these collection activities. Do add to collection. Add to collection. So the type again is expense report. Right, the collection is going to be, if it's less than 100, I'll put it into my accepted reports. And the item is going to be item. So you can see with this for each, right, it's very much like code where you do for each item in whatever. And I can change the name item to something else. But I've got access to that thing now in these child activities as I'm executing. So I'll put that in rejected reports, and that'll be same type. All right. So if I send in a bunch of reports, all right, I'm going to go through. Some of them are automatically accepted. Some of them are rejected. Those now are my output arguments, which means that I should be able to get access to those things when I execute this. So if we go out to our program. You know, again, if you've done workflow before, this is going to look a lot cleaner than what you'd get with a standard program. You could see that in order to run this workflow, I basically call workflow invoker.invoke. Say, go out and run this thing. I'm going to use the current thread, so it's just like making a method call. I want you to go invoke this thing, and if there are results, then I'm going to get those back. so I can get back some results from that. Now, in order to do that, I'm going to pass in my list of expense reports. Expense report. I've got a list of expense reports. So we'll just create a new report. We'll give the create a new employee, and then we'll do the amount equals. We don't need all the other stuff, and then we'll just create a few of these. That one will do 50, and this one will do 75. So I've got a set of reports. I want to pass those in. I need to pass in some arguments now to the workflow. And the way workflow expects arguments is in a dictionary. So if I look at workflow invoker.invoke, it wants the activity, and then it wants a dictionary of the inputs. So I'm going to do a new workflow. It's a dictionary of string object. And I need the name of this item to match up with the name of the argument within the workflow. All right, so it takes that name, it's going to come in here, and when we execute, it's going to look for an in argument named reports. And it's going to take that value and it's going to map it into there for me. So I've got the invoke. When I get the results, then I should also have my list of expense report, the rejected, because that results is also going to be a dictionary, right? String value based on the names of those things, so rejected reports. So I'll take that out. And then we'll get the accepted. And then we can just take a look at that information as we go. So then we can put just, we'll put something out so we know which one that was. So that was going to be item.amount. So we created a process. We're going to invoke that from code. We're going to pass in some arguments. It's going to process that thing based on our logic, and then we're going to get some results back out. To the client, to the caller, we don't really know what's going to happen in there. All right? Just like a function call. I know what I'm passing in. I know what I expect to get back out. I don't really know what the logic in there looks like, and I don't need to. So we pass that in. We get the rejected one at 500. We get accepted with all the typos at 50 and 75. Now, it used to be when I do workflow 3 demonstrations, I would never, on the first demonstration, I would never hit debug. I'd always do control F5. One of the things you'll notice is it's very fast to go out and execute that. I'm not doing anything fancy here. All right? It's not doing a lot of processing and logic. It's just .NET code. Right? And in the end, what I'm getting is classes, right, compiled down to IL that are going to go out and execute and allow me to run that programming logic. So we've got the arguments. You can see we've also got at these different levels, we've got variables that we can define as well. Works the same way. The difference is that the variables have that scope, Right? So they're scoped to whatever the container is. Here I'm putting it in the sequence. If I would come in and put another sequence in here, maybe drop these assigns in there. Then you can see as I go to create variables, I can scope those down and say for what portion of this workflow or where are these things available within the workflow for you to use. And that means that if I were in here, I would see that variable one in my IntelliSense. I'd be able to access it. But if I go outside of there and I try and use it somewhere in an expression, it doesn't even show up, right? It's not in scope, just like it's not in scope if you're in a method, for example. All right. So that's kind of the basic idea behind the workflows is that I model them out. They have arguments. I can execute them. I can get output back out of them. And I have these activities that are how I actually get work done and also how I control the flow in the application. Now, the activities are kind of this layered model. I have the two most common control flow activities, the sequence and the flow chart, that people will generally use for that main or that kind of high-level control flow. But I also have this whole library of things like the control flow for the for each and things. I've got the parallels. I have activities to do interop with old activities from workflow 3. I've got activities strictly around WCF messaging. So you kind of have this whole library around the core things that you need in the framework. And then we layer on top of those custom activities. So one of the things you learn when you start doing workflow or you start planning to do workflow is first thing you're going to do is start writing some custom activities to interact with your domain model, to interact with the various systems you want to talk to. That's the one thing that workflow doesn't really come with is a lot of activities that go out and get stuff done with different systems. Right. There were some plans early on to have database activity, PowerShell activity, but those things didn't quite make the cut when it came down to resources and testing, and so you'll find those have kind of been relegated down to samples in the SDK. Tools like Visual Studio Team System, right? Their build framework now uses workflow to define the build process. So if you go in and you want to customize in Team System in 2010, you want to customize your build process, you can go in and edit a workflow. You can write custom activities and use their custom activities to develop what that process looks like to do a team build. The other key thing with activities is this notion of composition. Right? For years and years, people have been talking about, we want reusable components. And I've worked at a lot of companies where they tried really hard to do reusable components, and they had source control and dependencies and all sorts of good stuff. But the idea with activities is that you might go out and create a set of activities that are very focused and very fine-grained, but I want to be able to come along and take those and compose them up into something that's bigger but still reusable. So I want to take that send email activity you've got and that one to send IMs, and I want to take some of these framework activities. I don't want to build an activity called Get Manager Approval. And just like all these other activities, I want you to just be able to drag it into your workflow and say, hey, at this point in the process, we need to go get the manager's approval. Again, internally, you don't really need to know what I'm doing in there. You don't need to know that I didn't write a bunch of code. All I did was take a bunch of existing activities and compose them together with things like error handling and timeouts. If the manager doesn't respond within 3 days, what do you do? You don't really need to know all of that. You just need to know how to drop that thing into your process and configure it and use it. So you can take all these kind of fine-grained activities and compose them together into more coarse-grained processes that you can reuse across your workflows. And a lot of what I see is at customers, they generally have, if they have a team that's working on workflow, they'll have certain people that are out building these activities and building composites of these activities. And then they'll have folks that do workflow development, right? They build the business processes on here. They just use all of those components, and they don't have to write them. They just need to know how to go write a workflow and be able to use all those activities and those components. Now, in workflow 3, there was this kind of weird mix of code-based workflows where it worked very much like a WinForm or a web form. You had some things that were designer-oriented, and then you flipped to the code behind view, and you wrote a bunch of code and event handlers. And then there was also this XAML with code behind. So what you saw in the designer was represented behind the scenes as XML or XAML, but you still had a code behind file, and they still got compiled together. Right? Ultimately, what people were trying to do and wanted to do but wasn't as easy is just put everything in XML. Put everything in the XAML. Right? Why? Because it's easier to tool. I can do things like store the XAML in a database or on the file system or in SharePoint. And if I have just an XML file now that I can take and pick up and execute, that can be pretty powerful in a lot of situations. Right? It's not compiled. It's not code that sits out in my, that has to be in a DLL that's out and deployed. I can load that thing up from the database, which means I can have somebody load it up into a custom designer, make changes, and save it back. And I can come along, you know, when I move that out to production. We're not just going to have people go changing stuff willy-nilly in production. I can take that now when I move it to production, and I just pick up that version and start executing. I don't have to necessarily redeploy my whole application. I'm just moving the data. Some folks at Microsoft like to talk about, you know, the data is the application, or the model is the application. Right? Once I define this, that is my application, and it just happens to be XML file that I can use. Right. So if you look at this file, it's a .xaml file. If we go and open that thing up, it's not something you'll probably want to read very often. But it's just a XAML file. It says, hey, I've got an activity. I've got these arguments you defined, these properties. All right, we've got in arguments and out arguments. And then you can see my hierarchy is just represented in XML. So I have a sequence, and I have a bunch of child activities underneath that. My expressions, all right, if we go and look, we had some code, are encoded in here. All right, so I've got my list over here of the contract expense report with just the square brackets on it. Now, what I did in my program was I said, well, I'm going to take this and create a new instance of it based on the type. All right, I compiled the XAML file. It created a type. Just like with WPF, that thing gets compiled. Right? But I can also simply go out and load that XAML file, the XML, and do the same with it, the same thing with it. Right? So I could do our file equal. If I could type the equal sign, file. What was it? Workflow1.xaml. So I can get that file, and then I have this class called ActivityXAMLServices, where I just call load, and I can pass in that stream, and what it's going to give you back is an activity. And so now I could come in here and just say, hey, I want to run that activity. I want to load that XML file. I want to take that now and have you turn it into an activity for me that I can execute, and I want to now go out and be able to execute that. We'll see if I typed everything right. So same program logic, but I didn't have to compile it into a class and put it in a DLL. I can go get that file from just about anywhere, as long as I can get it into a stream, right? And I can give it to this this component here that knows how to load it up and execute it. All right. So we've got a few different ways that we can execute this. I already mentioned the workflow invoker. Right, this is kind of the simple way for you. If you have a workflow where you're just going to execute it and it's going to finish and return, you can use that. Right? This is also what you would likely use if you're going to do unit testing. Right? You can use it to execute any activity. So I could take my write line activity and I could execute it with that, or my send mail, or my IM, or my get manager approval. Right? Any activity that I write, I can go out and execute with that. And then I have the ability to go in and test the results and see what out arguments came back from that. Right. We have the workflow application. And this is when you've got an activity that's going to be long running. Right. I'm going to have periodic points in the workflow where I'm going to stop and I'm going to be waiting for some event. Right. That event might be some sort of user interaction. That event might be a delay. Right. At this point in the process, we wait for 5 minutes. That event might be that I'm waiting for a WCF call, right, or some other custom event to happen from a backend system. Whatever it is, I've got my workflow and I'm going to start it. It's going to get to a particular point and then it's going to pause. And at some later point, I want to come back and resume that. Right? I want to pick up where I left off in the process. And that's one of the sweet spots for workflow, is being able to handle these longer running processes where they're kind of reactive or episodic in nature. Right? I do a chunk of work, I wait. I do a chunk of work, I wait. Right? And this allows me to pick up where I left off and still have one workflow that defines the entire process. Right? Here's my workflow application. I stop. When I come back, I know where to go next. I know what the next step is. Now, one of the things that enables that is this idea of workflow persistence. Because when I get to the point where I stop and I'm waiting for input, the workflow is considered to be idle. Right? It doesn't have any work to do. There's no activities because it's just waiting for something to happen. And when that happens, the runtime can take that workflow instance and its current state, and it can save it out to a database. And it saves out the in-scope variables and arguments. It saves out that notion of the bookmark, if you will, of where is that particular process paused. And so I know when we come back where to start it up again. Right. The workflow persistence, out of the box, you get a SQL Server version. And that allows me to do things like, hey, I've got a web application. I start up a workflow. Somebody's on a page in a particular server. I start up a workflow. I do some work, and then I pause. Well, they come back and they get load balanced to the other server. How do I resume that workflow? Well, you use the same database. When the workflow goes idle on the first process, or the first web server, then the runtime takes it, saves it out to the database with all its state. When the request comes back in on the other side, you pick up that workflow and just go from where you left off. Right? Signal it that the event has happened, right? Send that data into it. The process continues with the next steps that you have defined. So, you know, this gives us kind of the best of both worlds. If I have my definition of my process that's very declarative and very simple to create, gives me the ability for people to see what the process is doing, right? And I still get all the cool stuff like scalability and the ability to deal with, you know, moving between threads, moving between processes because of the way the state is managed for me. One of the other key features is this notion of tracking. Talk about having a runtime, and you know, one of the fears or the concerns that people have is, well, I've got this runtime. Isn't that adding overhead? I usually like to look at it as, well, what's the runtime giving me? Right, what do I get for having this runtime? I know there's going to be a cost. There always is. But what do I get? And one of the things we get with workflow is this idea of tracking. Because I have a runtime, and it's executing my activities, it knows everything that's happening. And so if I want to, I could ask it to tell me, hey, I want to know what's happening. I want to know when certain activities executed. I want to start collecting some data out of this thing so that I know what's going on in my business process, right? So that I can gain some visibility into time that it takes to do certain steps, right? We're getting complaints from users. Are we actually taking that long to ship the order, right? So I want to know, how long does it take in our process to get from point A to point B? I might also want to collect certain data, right? Hey, if you're sending emails out of the system, we've got compliance requirements that say we've got to know who it was to, what the subject was, what date you sent it. Tracking can provide me that information. I can track information, say, when you run this type of activity, track out these particular arguments from that activity. So it allows you to track events and give visibility into when certain steps took place, and it allows you to track data so that you can collect that for historical purposes, for compliance, whatever it might be. A tracking system is made up of two key things, a participant and a profile. The profile is what defines what data you care about. Because there's all sorts of data that's being collected, and the reality is you probably don't want all of it. So you define a tracking profile that says, well, here are the certain pieces of information that I want. And then you match that with a tracking participant. The participant is the thing that's actually listening and doing something with the data coming out of the runtime. So here you can see we kind of have this central listener inside workflow, and each of these things as we set it up and register, we're going to say, hey, you know what? I want you to apply this profile. So when you see these particular conditions, I want you to send a tracking record out to this participant. So in this case, I've got the out-of-the-box Enterprise Trace for Windows or ETW tracking participant that ships with Workflow 4. And I've got a custom file tracking participant. And each one has a different profile. So the ETW one might say, well, send me everything. And the file one just is a custom one. And I say, well, I just really want to start and stop. I want to have a log of workflows and when they started and when they completed. So as we go through the workflow and the events happen, you can see that all the events get sent up to that ETW tracking participant. And it simply gets a class, a tracking record, with all the data about what happened. And if our profile told it to track data, then that data elements would be in there too. And the file only gets called at the beginning and end, right? Only what its profile specified. So the tracking profile allows you to filter down from the start and say, only send me things I'm interested in, so that when it reaches the code of the tracking participant, it knows that it wants it and needs to just do something with it. Now, like I said, out of the box, you get this Enterprise Trace for Windows tracking participant. That means that all the data gets written out to this high-performance tracing level. Right? ETW is the same thing that the kernel and all the other stuff down in low-level Windows uses. But for those of you, again, that were using Workflow 3, what that means is there's no SQL. Right? It doesn't ship with a SQL tracking provider in Workflow 4, or tracking participant. There's something coming out. It's at beta 2 right now, called Windows Server App Fabric. It was previously known as Dublin. It's a set of tools that sits on top of IIS and uses PowerShell that's all about managing workflows and workflow services. And one of the features that it has is it will listen to that ETW trace, and it will take the data and store it into a database. So you can have a historical log. You can have a more durable, lasting store of that information. So while the framework itself doesn't come with a SQL trace, you do have the ability to collect some of that information with the upcoming release of App Fabric. All right. So let's go in here. I'm just going to add in a new class here. So we'll call this a console tracking participant. I'm going to use the tracking namespace. And you'll notice that in order to do custom tracking, it's pretty darn simple. Right? You have one method to override. So you may have ETW out of the box, but it's very easy for you to hook in your own custom tracking here. And you can identify, again, through the profile, what information you actually want to collect. And then your tracking participant can do whatever you want with it. Now, I found with tracking in Workflow 3 and previous versions that it was really the answer to a lot of the questions and the requirements that came out of the business. Right? The business said, hey, you know, we need to be able to figure out this information. And I'd see questions on the forums, or, you know, people would send me email. And tracking, because it hooks into every stage of the process, has access to what's happening when and has access to the data, really often allows you to get the information that you need. Let's go ahead here and we'll get the record and we'll get... So if we look at the record, you'll see it's got some basic information about the time, the number, level, things like that. Tracking records actually a base class. There are different areas that we can track in, and so I might come out and say activity state record. If that's not null, all right, then now we can see, now I've got also information about the arguments. Right. So if I'm getting information about a particular activity that's maybe finished or has just started executing, then I can now look into it and see, well, what were the current arguments for that thing? What are the in-scope variables that were around at that time? All right, I get more information about that particular tracking record. Am I missing it? Oops. So we've got activity.arguments. All right, we can see that the... So the item, right, has the key and a value, right? It's basically just a collection of what was the name of that thing and what's the value. Right. So we'll write out the arguments at that point. So we can do whatever we want. Here I'm writing it out, so you might save it out to a store like SQL. You might keep it in memory. You might create a service out of this that does RSS feeds, right? You could do whatever you want to manage these bits of information. And then the program, I need to add that in before I go out here and execute this thing. So I'm going to need to provide my tracking participant, my console, and then I need to set the profile into that as well. So I need to be able to instruct Workflow as to what it should actually provide or what it is that I want it to collect. All right, so I've got in here my invokers, I've got the I need to create my invoker in order to set that. So I can go into the extensions and just add that profile. My activity, right? So I create that, I go out and invoke. Now I can get rid of that. So I've added in that tracking, right? I just need to tell it what it is it should track. So I'll create a new tracking profile. The activity definition is basically, well, what kind of workflow do you want to track? Here I'm going to kind of leave that wide open because I know I'm only running one particular type. And then the queries, right? gives me the ability now to add in a set of queries. So I can come in here and I could do an activity state query. Where here we can do the activity name. And I'll say the state is closed. I'll say, look, I want to track anytime an activity is closed. And that's an array. I think it's a collection, new. Collection of strings. Oh, that's why. Can't find collection. Okay. What am I missing there? States equal new. After the. This? No, this should be initializing that. States is renal. Well, we'll cheat then. All right, so now I think we've got it. I don't want it in. Too many. There we go. So when an activity closes and we want to track things out, we've added in that tracking profile. And so now we can see every time a particular activity executes, right, we're writing it out. In this case, we don't have any specific argument queries as part of our profile, so we're not getting any arguments back. Right. So this is a kind of a simple example of taking that information and writing it out, but you can see that you can take that information and you can collect it out and store it for historical purposes. You've got the ability to take that, and with the designer you can visualize that stuff. So you can take that information and you could layer it on top of the visual designer for the workflow, so that you could actually see that information in the terms of the visualization, when what activities executed and which ones didn't, so you could see what path was followed through the flow of your workflow. So using that historical data can give you some powerful visibility into your processes and what happens there. All right, and then the last piece is, you know, workflow is really kind of its own. To use an overloaded term, its own DSL. So it allows you to create activities that encapsulate whatever logic you want. So you might have activities that talk to your business objects, your domain model, activities that talk to your back-end systems. And it allows you then to create these activities that your developers then can come in and say, well, I need to go build this new application for somebody, and I have to go talk to that system. Great, start defining your logic, drag in this activity and configure it, and we'll be able to go out and call that system as part of this process. Right. You might also want to create custom control flow. Right. Try going into C# or Visual Basic and adding a new control flow statement. Right. You've got if, you've got while, you've got certain things in there, but try going in and adding a new control flow statement. You just can't do it to the language, right, to the compiler. So with workflow, you can just create a new activity, and it can be in charge of the control flow. It can say, hey, this is how I'm going to execute my child program statements or my child activities. I'm going to make decisions about when one completes what to do next. All right. So with activities, we have this base notion of the activity itself, and then you've got a choice of really kind of depending on the model of your activity, which base activity you're going to use. So we have the code activity, which is I'm going to write an activity. I want a method where I can just drop some .NET code to do stuff. I'm going to look at my arguments. I'm going to set some outputs, but I'm just going to write .NET code. Right. I've got the native activity, which is I'm going to write one of those control flow activities or a more advanced activity that really needs the ability to get down into low level of workflow. I'm going to schedule other activities, or I'm going to, you know, control other activities that are in the process, or I'm going to create what's called a bookmark. I'm going to be able in my activity to say, hey, the workflow should pause here, and I want to allow somebody to come back and pass me data and resume from where I left off. And then they've added this async code activity. And the idea here is, well, look, if I'm going to take this notion of the parallel, I'm going to say, hey, I want to do things in parallel. That only really works if the activities themselves know how to go do stuff asynchronously. And so you have this async code activity where you have the begin after or begin end model, where you simply override the begin execute and the end execute, and you then automatically get the async behavior. So a lot of the logic about waiting and spinning off the threads and calling all this stuff is pushed out of your activity code and into the runtime. And then the rest of these are kind of convenience methods. This whole piece over here on the right, where we've got the activity of T result and these others, this is really all about I've got an activity, and much like a lot of methods just return a single output value, I've got an activity, and when it runs, it has one output argument. All these are is kind of a nice wrapper around that. So you derive from one of these where T result is the type of your return, and it automatically has in the base class the output argument defined, and all you have to do is set it. So it's just kind of simplification for you of doing that. All right. So when you think about going in and building your activities, there's a couple different options here. One is a declarative activity, which is really nothing all that different from what you saw me do in the workflow. I'm going to go in, I'm going to compose a bunch of activities together in a declarative fashion. I'm going to define arguments, and I'm going to package that up and say, okay, now I have an activity that you can call. Right? Or I'm going to use one of those base types, and I'm going to go out and write some code. I'm going to do async, or I'm going to do native, or do the basic code activity. I'm going to define my arguments, and then I'm going to go out and write the execution logic. So if we use a simple example here, I'll go out. What you'll notice is if you go out and do new item and you add an activity, what you're going to get is a XAML file. That's the declarative model. That's where you're going to go out and write an activity that is modeled out just like your workflows, and where you're going to compose other activities together. The code activity gives you the code base model. So we'll do the typical code activity here, send mail. So when we get in here, you can see I've got a base class, and it's got some arguments defined for me. I'll just clear that out. So you need to define properties, but instead of just saying it's a string, you want to do an in argument of string. And what that allows you to do is use those expressions in the editor. If you just declare this as a string, somebody can come in and just type in a string to set it. If you call it an in argument of string, now they can use expressions. They can refer to variables in the workflow. They can go out and call .NET types. Their expression that they write needs to resolve to a string. Right? When they're done, what they return to you needs to be a string. But because it's an argument, they can do that with expressions. We can do some simple properties here, and then we override the execute method. Now, when you get into the execute, right, the arguments and the variables are all scoped, and they're all available inside this thing called the context, which you get passed. Right? The context is really in your activity to handle to the runtime and to be able to do things. So I might do a mail message, system.net mail. I do a new mail message. And I want to create this, and I've got, you know, from to subject and body. But I can't just do from address because that's not a string. It's an in argument of string. And so I need to call get and pass in that context. I can get that IntelliSense to go away. Right? So I use the argument and I say, well, give me the value of this argument in the current context. So you can see I'm doing that for all of those properties. So I've got a mail message. And I could do a send then on my message. Right. So once you get into the actual execution, the logic is just .NET code, right? It's fairly straightforward. You just have to keep in mind that you have a specific way to access those arguments and to set those results. Right. So now let's go out and we'll add our test project. All right, so I've got an add a reference to my project. I'm going to go add a add an app config out here. Because I don't actually want to send any mail. I'm just going to configure that and say, look, when you go to send mail for this SMTP class, you can tell it, look, don't try and call a server. Just go set it out in cmail, which hopefully it still exists. Yep. So I can go into my test now, and I can go in and execute that activity. So I've got a reference over to my project. I need a reference to system activities because that's where the core of workflow exists. There you go. So now I can do send mail. And now I can use that workflow invoker, right, to go out and invoke one of these things. So I can say workflow invoker dot invoke, and I can pass in then my workflow or my activity, and then a dictionary of my inputs. Can pass those four in. And we'll just keep it simple. So I've got the body and I've got the subject. Right. So if I go invoke my test, right, passed, not surprisingly, because I didn't actually do any asserts. Kind of doing this backwards and starting with green, but then you can see the mail gets sent out with the subject and the body out there. Obviously, I could add in some asserts, go find that. I could clean up the directory before and after and use that to test those things. So a couple other things I'll mention. One is that I mentioned the bookmarks. All right, you have this ability with your activities to say, hey, I want to pause the workflow right here. And I can come back later and use that workflow application and simply say, hey, resume that bookmark. Right? I know you're waiting at a particular point in the workflow. I want to resume that bookmark. I want to send some data into the workflow and have it start processing again. The other is activity actions. And this is what you saw with that for each activity. And you can put these in your own activities as well, where you can kind of think of it as an activity template, right? Where in the for each activity, it basically said, hey, look, I'm going to give you this point in the activity, and I'm just going to let you plug in whatever you want. So you can write your own activities, and you can say, well, I have most of the processing defined, but I want to allow you to extend my activity when you use it or provide a particular implementation for this piece. Maybe for my email activity, I want to give you a chance to put in a bunch of activities that create the email message. I don't want to force you to just put it on an argument. I'm going to give you a point right before I send where you can use a bunch of activities and assign things and manipulate and create a nice big email body that I can send. And then all of those, the activities can have custom designers. Right? You can decide, what does that thing look like? How do you interact with it when it's on the design surface? Am I going to have these text boxes where you can edit certain arguments? Am I going to have places where you can put in child activities? And all of that is based on WPF. So it means that you can make it look as good as you can with WPF. Right. If you really know your stuff and you start, you know, applying styles and doing things like that, you've got access to all the pieces of WPF that allow you to make it look nice, but also provide the rich interaction. And they give you a key set of framework elements for WPF, the workflow view element, the workflow item and items presenters, and the expression text box. So the expression text box is that little text box you see that gives you the IntelliSense and gives you the ability to put in those expressions on the design surface. And then the workflow item and items presenter are all about, hey, if I have a child activity that drops inside, or like the sequence has many different activities, those make it simpler for you to display those things on the designer. So they've really tried to make it a lot easier for you to give your developers or your whoever's building your workflows a streamlined experience and a customized experience so that, you know, they get the help they need from the designer in terms of how to correctly configure that activity. And they've also, you know, somebody asked about MVVM or the model view view model. That's a pattern that they've applied here where what your designer actually gets is this thing called a model item, right? And it's an abstraction on top of your activity. And so you get the ability to do XAML data binding on there, right, and take full advantage of all the WPF data binding capabilities on top of your activity. So you could just say, hey, this text box is bound to my my subject on my activity. And all that stuff just works in there. Right. And they've taken that a step further, and that whole designer within the Visual Studio is just a WPF control. And it's part of the framework. And that means you can take that and you can put it in your own application along with whatever, you know, you decide what's in the toolbox. If you want to use the toolbox, you can reuse the property grid if you want to, and you can put your own activities in there. So you can provide somebody pretty easily, I think in about, you know, a half an hour, you could have a workable designer that's up and running and that somebody could come in and design a workflow in XAML and save it out somewhere. Right? So it's much, much improved over the workflow 3 where, you know, you needed a 20-page article and all sorts of code in order to just get it working. All right. So hopefully that gives you a little sense of what workflow is. Right? It provides that declarative programming model for you to build out your program logic. You can do execution with the invoker where it's really short-lived, much like calling a method. Or you can have the longer running workflows where you can have those pauses in between. And when we talk about WCF later today, I'll talk about how you can use workflow and WCF together to build out the logic of your services as well. All right. Any questions at this point? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the question was, if I take my workflow and I persist it, and then I find a bug or I need to make a change to the definition, can I do that and will it work when it resumes? Unfortunately, the answer is one of those, it depends. It's much better than in the previous versions. The previous versions, the answer would be no. All right, it would just break if you change the model for the most part. But because what you do when you reload it is you actually will give it the activity definition again. So when you say you want to load it back up from persistence, you're going to say, hey, here's the model, right, which would be your new updated activity with all the changes, and I want you to go load it up from the database. So it's going to go try and load up the bookmark information and load up the variables and that sort of thing. So you know, depending on the changes you made, the chances of it working are a lot better than it used to be. But you do still have to be careful about how significant the changes are that you've made and whether the state that was saved can be loaded back up. But kind of the two things that drive that are, it's all XAML now, and you give it the activity definition. It's not just trying to binary deserialize that thing. And the other is that it's not saving as much state. So it's mostly saving out the variables and the actual state and not just a big serialized object that it's trying to work with. Good question. So a workflow that you create in SharePoint, is that a XAML file that you can open here? It is a XAML file. It's actually an XOML file. SharePoint 2007 and 2010 both use workflow from .NET Framework 3.5. So SharePoint 2010, that's probably a good distinction. It's going to still have workflow, but it's not using the .NET 4 version. And that's basically because they're both coming out about the same time and you know they couldn't actually test it. So so they're not using this new XAML model. The designer does create XAML or XML, XOML files, and you could take those and open them with the designer. I believe they're doing some more work there with 2010 to make it easier for you to move from one to the other. Why don't we go ahead and take a break? If people have other questions, feel free to stop down. And we'll start up again at 2:45, I think, with the talk about Entity Framework and the WCF Data Services.